Today we're going to start talking about the medical side of fasting. And as I threw my credibility away yesterday, you know, I'm not a medical expert on fasting. I'm just going to parrot some of the things that I've read. I've got about 7 books with me on fasting. So if you're interested in the medical side of fasting in more detail, I'd be glad to lend one of these books to you to read that go into detail. I got to tell you a true confession. You know, back home my nickname is Bubba. You know, I was raised, you know, Southern fried, you know, Southern fried white gravy on everything sort of a guy, you know. Put white gravy on your white gravy. And I haven't been into nutrition, as you can probably tell by looking at me. And I'm starting to become a believer in this thing called nutrition and eating well. And I went to this exhibit yesterday, The Body Works. And if you want to see what you can do to your body on the inside, that'll scare you straight, let me tell you. I'm not a person that has a long history of being a tofu eater. That's not my history. So let's talk about the medical side of fasting. All right. Let's see if we can get this going today. There we go. Just some facts here. 300,000 deaths in the U.S. each year are attributed to poor diet and lack of physical activity. For 20 to 74-year-olds, the prevalence of obesity increased from 15% in 1976 to 1980 to 32.9%, or a third of our population, 2003-2004. So I want you to look to your left, and I want you to look to your right. If the person beside you is not obese, it's you. You'll be surprised. I'm going to show you in a minute just what obesity is considered by the U.S. government, and you can work the numbers and see how you fit into the scale, the body mass index. So it's kind of scary. Why are we getting fatter? One of the reasons, I think, is that we've got low-cost food, low nutritional value food. It's processed, has little nutritional value, but it tastes good and it's cheap and you can get plenty of it. We got larger portions. You know, things keep getting bigger and bigger. You go to a restaurant and it's hard to eat all what they put in front of you. You know, they give you family-sized portions, you know, which are individual servings. And, you know, just one of the things I've never really understood is, they'll give you all this nutritional information. So you get, let's say you get a bag of, little bag of M&Ms or something. And you read on the back, the nutritional information on the back and you think, oh, well, that's not too bad, you know. And then you realize this is like 6 servings in this little bag, you know. So you got to multiply everything by 6. You're thinking, man, I could just gobble this in one, you know, handful. We've got more money and less time. So that translates, you know, to more fast food, more restaurants. The killer for me is that lack of time. So I'm running around doing all these things that I'm doing, and I've got 15 minutes to eat, and I'm in the car. What are you going to do, right? McDonald's, Burger King, Kentucky Fried Chicken, something like that. You're going to whip in there, and you're going to eat in the car while you're driving down talking on your cell phone, which is another health hazard we'll get to in another class. That'll be my stress class. Marketing. You know, we are bombarded with selling us this processed, fat-filled, cholesterol-filled food. You know, very few things are you know, do you see the Fresh Vegetable Association, you know, selling us anything. It's usually, you know, McDonald's or you know, Nabisco or somebody selling us some sort of something. Or the beer people, you know. I mean, you know, you can't watch a sporting event without 47 beer commercials in any given sporting event. And then we're getting less exercise, you know. We used to be an agrarian society, and you'd work out on the farm all day, and then you started working in factories, but you're still getting physical labor. Well, now we're, you know, all sitting in air-conditioned offices and pushing pencils. And we're riding the elevator up and to our offices and then in our car to and from work. The only real exercise we get is walking back and forth to the refrigerator. So less exercise, and it's caused by the urban sprawl and the automobile and so forth. So it's a lifestyle that we've adopted. And, you know, we're just sort of a crazy culture anyway, you know, because we'll drive around for 5 minutes to see, you know, how close we can get to the door of the gym, right? So what are the risks of being overweight? Hypertension, and I'm gonna guess on this next one, dyslipidemia, something like that. Any doctors or nurses want to tell me what that is? Am I close? Dyslipidemia, thank you. High total cholesterol, high level of triglycerides, type 2 diabetes. Diabetes is going through the roof in the U.S. Coronary heart disease, stroke, gallbladder disease, osteoarthritis, sleep apnea, respiratory problems, some cancers, endometrial breast and colon cancers. And that's just a small list of the risks that come from being overweight. So here's where you get to have a little fun, if you're so inclined. If you don't want to know, don't do it. Here's what you do. If you want to know how you stack up, what you do, how you stack up, you multiply your weight times 703, and then you divide it by your height in inches squared. So you multiply your height twice, and that'll tell you this fancy calculation called your body mass index. So if you want to write that thing down, I'm going to show you the chart here in a minute, and it'll tell you what your body mass index is. And this will tell you, according to the government, and of course that's subject to some debate right there, but this will tell you whether you're obese, whether you're just overweight, or whether you're a normal weight. And I find this really scary. I won't tell you where I fell on the scale. Yeah, you multiply your height. Your height. Oh yes, your height squared. You multiply that. You know, so if you're, yeah, if you're 60 inches, 60 times 60. That's just how they figure it out. I don't know what the 703 is. It's the number they came up with to come up with the body mass index. That makes it work, but I don't know why it makes it work. That's a John Launchbury question. The medical question, he said. He's deferring to the medical people. Okay, so there it is. If you got that down, now here's what it does. So now if you come up with that number, you got your height over here and then your weight. So you do the matrix to come up to your... So if you come up with the number 27 and you're 6'1" and 200 pounds, you have a body mass index of 27. And because you're in the red, that means you're obese. If you are 6'1" and you weigh 210 pounds, you are obese, according to the U.S. government. If you're in the If you're in the, you're borderline on the yellow, and then the green, you're just overweight.
Isn't it different for men and women?
What's that?
I thought it was different for men and women.
Is it different for men and women? I don't think. I'm getting a head nod this way. I don't think it is.
Get
to the next chart. Moving right along. Canadians, yes, totally. It's in metric then. They're all conversed in metric. So here it is. A BMI of less than 18.5 is underweight. A BMI of 18.5 to 24.9 is normal weight. A BMI of 25 to 29 is overweight. A BMI of 30 to 39 is obese. And a BMI of 40 or higher is severely or morbidly obese. So, I'm not doing this to offend anybody, but just a little self-examination. And like I said, I wasn't real thrilled with this. But it was an eye-opener. And you know, it's one thing, you know, to know that you've got a problem, and another thing not to know. And I'd rather know I have a problem than just to go around, you know, ignorant. So here's what happens when we fast. Reminds me of our little exhibit yesterday, doesn't it? Well, what happens day one is the first day that you fast, there's a breakdown of your glycogen. And I'm not even sure what glycogen is, but it gets broken down. And it's stored in your liver. So that happens on the first day of fasting. The second day, the body turns to protein and fat reserves for energy. And the third day, the liver produces ketones, and this is called ketosis. And if you remember the, I do remember this, that Atkins diet where you just eat nothing but cheese and beef and meats, that's a way of getting your body to go into ketosis. That's what the Atkins diet does for you, by filling your body full of meats and cheeses and eggs too, you can eat, right?
Yeah.
All right?
Anything non-sugar.
So then, and your body starts flushing itself of these impurities. The first thing it starts attacking is the stuff that you want it to attack, the abnormal stuff and everything, and it starts getting rid of it and starts flushing out your body. And one of the side effects, by the way, of fasting is that you start getting bad breath and stuff like that because this stuff is coming out of you. Day four, ketosis and it continues for like, you know, let's say 40 days. And where that starts to happen varies by individuals, but, you know, for then depending on your fat stores, really. So, you know, I might be able to go months, right? But once you start, and again, you're not really that hungry during this time, but the first 3 days you're hungry. After that, you're not that hungry. And then once that hunger really kicks in again, that's when you're starting to die. You're starting to eat yourself internally to survive. And you're starving to death. So, you know, they say somewhere around the 40th day that starts to happen. These books say, if you're just wondering, you know, the first X number of days, you know, 5 or 10 days, you'll lose about 2 pounds a day. After that, you'll lose about a pound a day. So it's it depends. Now, after you've been fasting for a period of time, you have to break the fast, right? And they have a...
I have a question.
Yes.
Are you going to discuss a healthy amount of length of fasting time?
The question was, Rachel said, what's a healthy fasting time? And I'll give you my highly uneducated opinion. What these books say is that start off with a small fast. You know, start off 24 hours or and then work your way up. And they said, you know, don't go for a 21-day or 40-day fast, you know, and especially if you're overweight or have a medical condition, you know, definitely talk to your doctor. But they say build up. You know, it's like you don't start off running by running a marathon, right? You start off, you know, running a half mile or something and train yourself to do that. Well, one of the books I was just reading was saying that this gentleman recommended a fast of at least one day a week of 24 to 36 hours, and then four times during, and he suggests just do it during the change of the seasons, a 10-day fast. But he said build up to that first. And he said this is, and he was looking at this not from a spiritual point of view, but from a health point of view. He said this would really increase your length of life and your health, and would really, pardon?
Four times a year,
10-day fast, and then once a week, a 24 to 36 hour fast. All right. Afterwards,
yeah.
After the fast, actually your stomach shrinks. So good segue into the next one, breaking the fast. After you've fasted, don't have a 16-ounce steak or something. Start with some fresh fruit or something like that, because your stomach has stopped producing digestive enzymes. And so you need to slowly get back into this bit of eating. And also your stomach has shrunk, so you probably will be more inclined to eat smaller portions after you have done this fasting. Contrary to that, you're not going to eat twice as much. You're probably going to eat half. You're more likely to eat half than you are to eat twice as much after the fast. Yes? Which one?
Day 1, 2, 3.
Oh, 1, 2, and 3. Gotcha.
Yeah, we just can get that off my website.
Okay.
Maybe
yeah, I can give you this the slides to put on the website. Yes. I don't remember what they said about like frequency of meals. But you're welcome to one of these books, and they kind of go into gory detail and stuff where my eyes sort of glaze over, And like I said, I mean, I'm not that into the medical side of it. I'm more into the spiritual side of it, but I'm giving you the medical side because if you're like me, when you start hearing about this, you're going, well, wait a minute, aren't you going to mess yourself up or something like this by doing this? And actually, it's very, very healthy to do this. Do we have day 1, 2, 3? Got that? Okay. So breaking the fast, and that's where we get our term, of course, breakfast, which means break fast. You've been fasting all night, right, by sleeping, and so you eat break fast, if you didn't know that. Now, here's the downside. This was mentioned yesterday. Here's some possible, emphasis on possible, side effects from fasting. If you are a caffeine-aholic, you might get a caffeine headache. I did when I started doing this, and I've really made a concerted effort to cut out. I was not a coffee drinker, never have been a coffee drinker. I was a soda drinker. I was a Diet Coke in the morning person. You might get a headache related from that. But again, if you don't go back on the coffee or the sodas after that, you won't ever experience that again. And, we should be drinking water anyway. That's much more healthy for us. And by the way, tap water, I found out the other day on 60 Minutes, is healthier than bottled water, unless you've got some messed up system. Well, they said most often it's caffeine related. You know, if you're a coffee, lack of caffeine causes a caffeine headache. Well, you might get a caffeine headache if you start fasting and you're used to drinking, you know, 3 cups of coffee every morning. You're probably going to get a headache. You know, caffeine is a drug. You know, it gets us pumped up. You know, and our body becomes used to that and everything, and it constricts your blood vessels in your brain or something like that. I don't know what it does. Constricts your blood vessels in your brain and stuff. And anyway, dizziness. We mentioned, somebody was talking yesterday about being dizzy. I've experienced that I've had this since I was a kid. If I stand up too quick, sometimes I'll get faint. Well, when I fast, that happens more frequently. It'll happen once every 3 months normally, but if I'm fasting, it'll happen more frequently than that. Abdominal pains, you know, that I've had the growling stomach, and I think that's a good thing. That's what reminds me that why I'm doing it and to think about God or whatever the reason is I'm fasting. I haven't experienced trembling and I haven't experienced nausea from it, but they say those are side effects that one can experience. Lack of coordination? Trembling? I don't know. Since I haven't experienced, I don't know what they mean by trembling. I have a shaky. I probably wouldn't know. I have what's called a benign familial tremor. Anyway, my hands just shake naturally from hereditary. And so if I did shake, I probably wouldn't notice it being any different. You're what? Feels if you're shaking inside. Okay. Lack of coordination? Anyway, I don't know. But that's interesting that you bring that up, because I went to a football game when I was on the third day of a 3-day fast. It was cold out, but I've never been so cold in my life. And I left at halftime, which, for those of you who know me, doesn't happen. even though it was a blowout, it was like 51-0 at halftime, I still would have stayed, but I was so cold. So yeah, I think you probably do feel colder when you fast, because your body's not, you know, burning off all that food. Good question. But there's medical evidence. There's medical evidence, and again, I'm just telling you what other people say. And what I've got one of the books is, or two of the books are by doctors. You know, that it will help with cardiovascular and circulatory diseases, migraines, glaucoma, digestive diseases, liver diseases, Crohn's disease, chronic colitis, ulcerated colitis, skin diseases, cirrhosis, eczema, bronchial asthma, depression. So the benefits that come from this are long-term and lasting, according to the medical community. Again, I don't know. I'm just regurgitating what they've said. There's also a lot of psychological evidence that it helps with psychological conditions. One of the ones I just thought was interesting that they quoted was in Japan, this was quoted in the Sapporo Medical Journal, out of 382 patients with psychological conditions, 87% were cured through fasting. I thought that was pretty amazing. Now here's just some quotes. And you know, the funny thing about quotes is you can find somebody that has a quote about anything that'll say anything. So with a grain of salt, here are some quotes. I believe fasting is the missing link in the Western diet. Most people overeat, eat too often, eat high protein, high fat, rich food, building and congesting more diet more consistently than they need. Elson Haas, MD. Some doctors believe that pure water fasting can not only detoxify cells and rejuvenate organs, but can actually cure such diseases and conditions as cardiovascular disease, rheumatoid arthritis, asthma, high blood pressure, type 2 diabetes, colitis, psoriasis, lupus, and other autoimmune disorders when combined with a healthy diet. They believe fasting is nature's restorer. If you notice the quote I had right up at front, Cloris Leachman, who is some sort of TV actress, but I can't remember for the life of me what she was on. But we're, I think we're going back to the 70s then. Anyway, she said it cured her of her asthma.
Mary Tyler Moore.
Mary Tyler Moore?
And Rhoda.
And Rhoda. Okay. There you go. Way to go, Cloris. All right. So, 70 TV shows. Yeah. Yeah, and again, take everything I'm saying here with a grain of salt. You know, I don't know. This is what these books I've been reading, and you know, you're welcome to read and kind of figure it out for yourself. This is not my forte by any stretch of the imagination, but I thought you know, this would sort of fill it out a little bit on how this all works. You know, and again, you know, God typically tells us to do stuff that's for our best interest, right? He doesn't typically tell us to do things that are counterproductive to our health. You know, you just look at, statistically, you know, church-going, regular church-going people live longer than non-church-going people. You know, why is that? Well, I would suggest it's because of the lifestyle that goes along with it. You're not, you know, if you're not taking illegal drugs, and you're not sexually promiscuous, and you're not, you know, engaging in behaviors that are risky, like robbing banks. You know, you tend to live longer, and I think it just works out that way. I don't think there's any magic to that. It's just like, you know, there's no guarantee you're not going to die young fasting, you know, but there's no guarantee if you brush your teeth that you're not going to get a cavity, right? But if you don't brush your teeth, probably going to get some tooth decay and gum disease. All right. Here's another one. Recent studies on mice show that fasting every other day while eating double the normal amount of food on non-fasting days led to better insulin control, neuronal resistance to injury, and health indicators similar to mice on calorie-restricted diets. This may mean that alternate day fasting is an alternate is an alternative to caloric restriction for life extension. Just stuff. Anyway, like I said, I got books. You're welcome to borrow them and take them home and read them if you're interested in all the medical. I skimmed over this because I didn't want this to be the focus of our study. We're here to get spiritual things, but there's medical evidence on this also. So let's talk about something that I think is absolutely fascinating, and it's on a spiritual level. We'll get started with this. Successful fasting. Here's a quote from Jesus. Ask and it will be given to you. Search and you will find. Knock and the door will be opened to you. Everyone who asks receives, and everyone who searches finds, and everyone who knocks will have the door open. Is there anyone among you who would hand his son a stone when he has asked for bread, or would hand him a snake when he asked for a fish? If you, then, evil as you are, know how to give your children what is good, how much more will your Father in heaven give good things to those who ask him? And the reason I bring this up, it kind of goes back to what we were talking about yesterday. There is a correlation, in my mind anyway, to the desire for godly things. The more we search, the more we seek, the more we want it, the more we strive for it, the more God works with us and the more He gives us what we want. I really believe in the ultimate sense, God gives everybody their heart's desire. If you want the things of this world, He'll give it to you. If you want the kingdom of God with all your heart, He is more than happy and pleased to give it to you. But every man really, ultimately, I think, gets what they want. If you want this 70 years, he'll give it to you. If you want eternal life, he'll give it to you. So this really comes down to, in my mind, striving for God. And he says there, it's not couched in any sort of weasel words that you might hear. You know, he says this is everyone. This is not limited. This is to everyone that wants it. So it's a relationship to effort. We also have this very, very strange parable. I think this is one of the strangest parables in the Bible, where God is compared to an unjust judge. And the parable reads in Luke 18, 1-8, it says, "And he spake a parable unto them to this end, that men ought always to pray and not to faint, saying, There was in a city a judge which feared not God, neither regarded man. And there was a widow in that city, and she came unto him and saying, Avenge me on mine adversary. And he would not for a while. But afterward he said within himself, Though I fear not God, nor regard man, yet because this woman widow troubleth me, I will avenge her, lest her continual coming she weary me. And the Lord said, Hear what the unjust judge saith, and shall not God avenge his own elect, which cry day and night unto him, though he bear long with them? I tell you that he will avenge them speedily. Nevertheless, when the Son of Man comes, shall he find faith on the earth?" So, to me, the point of the parable seems to me to be that if an unjust judge will grant someone their request because of persistence, how much more will God grant us, who is a just judge, if we are persistent? To me, it's a parable about persistence, about sticking with it and fighting for it and doing your part. So when we turn the subject over to fasting, we get a similar lesson. And this is from Joel chapter 2, 12 to 18. "Therefore also now saith the Lord, Turn ye even to me with all your heart and with fasting. Turn with all your heart and with fasting, and with weeping and with mourning, and rend your heart and not your garments. And turn unto the Lord your God, for he is gracious and merciful and slow to anger, and of great kindness, and repenteth him of evil. And who knoweth if he will return and repent and leave a blessing behind him, even a meat offering and a drink offering unto the Lord your God? Blow the trumpet in Zion, sanctify a fast, and call a solemn assembly. Gather the people, sanctify the congregation, assemble the elders, gather the children and those that suck the breast, and let the bridegroom go forth out of his chamber, and the bride of her closet. Let the priests and the ministers of the Lord weep between the porch and the altar, and let them say, Spare thy people, O Lord, and give not thine heritage to reproach, that the heathen should rule over them. Wherefore should they say among the people, Where is their God? Then will the Lord be jealous for his land and pity his people." So again, it's not about the ritual. It's about the substance behind the ritual. It's about really, really seeking for God and trying to get closer to God. Here's the punchline. This is our verse again. This is our theme verse for the class. And if you get anything out of the class, get this. The verse says, "I will set my face unto the Lord God to seek by prayer and supplications with fasting." Fasting is a way to seek God. It is a means to seek God. And that's what it's about. It is about seeking God, seeking His will, seeking His guidance, seeking His divine intervention. It's about seeking God. Question? Right. I think that's only partially true, though. Although it did take a lot of time to prepare food back then, they had to kill it and pick it and stuff. You know, they had servants that did a lot of that, and they had, you know, the men weren't doing any of that. Maybe they go kill something and bring it in, but time, I think, is a part of it. It's a factor in it. You know, to devote, take some time and devote that towards things. But I don't think that's the essence of it. I think the essence of it is the denial of self, the focus on God, and the reminder constantly that you are, for what you are fasting. Yeah. Well, they were doing it communally and individually. You know, Daniel, there's no indications, like, for example, that Daniel was doing it as part of a communal thing. Daniel was doing it individually for individual reasons. And so it can be a communal thing, but it can be a very individual thing, a personal thing. And Jesus alludes to that when he says, look, when you're fasting, don't let people know that you're fasting. Well, if it was a communal thing, everybody would know because everybody would be doing it. But if it's a very private thing, then you're not going to, you know, make an announcement in a meeting, hey, everybody, I'm fasting today. You just do it and get your benefit from it and grow closer to God through it. Yes. No, and this was there's three types of fasting. There's the normal fast, which is just absence of food. There's the absolute fast, which is no food and no water. And then there's the partial fast, where you're just giving up something, like, you know, you're giving up meat, or you're giving up sugar, or you're giving up something like that. Potato chips. Miss Vicky's potato chips. Yes. Now, some people have mentioned to me, you know, this, and I think we're just about out of time, but I'll say one last thing. Some people have mentioned to me this idea, you know, about, you know, the Catholics and Lent and, you know, so forth, and how they'll give up, you know, chocolate, or they'll give up whatever. You know, again, that could be a legitimate form of fasting, or that could be a very legalistic form of fasting. You know, it goes back to what's in your heart and what's the purpose for it. If you're saying, you know, look, everybody expects me to fast, so I'm going to do it, you know, just to, so nobody will say anything to me. Or if you're doing it to lose weight, which is a great, you know, valid way to lose weight, but that's your purpose for doing it. Whatever, just saying, you know, we need to have the right motives into going into this. It needs to be a spiritual exercise. It can be a physical exercise, and there can be side benefits, medical benefits, but primarily, I think we should be going into this with the attitude of it being a spiritual exercise. Any other comments? I think I'm out of time, all right? No, I'm not out of time. I have 10 minutes. Any other questions on that before we go to the next slide?
Yeah.
We're going to talk about that one. Saul demanding that his army not eat. We'll get to that one. The question is about low blood sugar and what the effects are on your level of blood sugar. And the answer is, I don't know, but it's all in these books. I'll be glad to let you borrow one that'll talk about that. But I don't know what happens to your the glucose levels and things like that. Yeah.
How can it be spiritually helpful if you're feeling miserably uncomfortable through your low blood sugar or hunger?
Yeah. The question was, if you've got low blood sugar and you're feeling miserably uncomfortable, and I'll just give you my opinion, and again, my uneducated opinion, or slightly educated opinion. If you're feeling miserable, I mean, if it's more than just hunger pains or something like that, I would check with my doctor, because if you're really feeling miserable, there might be something more severe going on. So I would... Oh, absolutely. I mean, you're right. If you're getting flu-like symptoms, you know, from fasting, you're probably not going to be the most spiritually minded person. But if you're getting, you know, some hunger pains, I think that can be helpful. For me, it has been. There's some other hand back here. Yeah. Probably. Yep. We have a medical doctor present, and he can. Where is he? Oh, he left. He didn't want to hear it. Blowhard, I'm out of here. Right. Yeah, especially if you've got some sort of medical condition, you're hypoglycemic or diabetic or morbidly obese or, you know, right, or extremely underweight or something. Yeah, right.
I grew up having no meat of Christ. We had fish. And it was a theological thing that we weren't tested, but we carried over. And I never did know what the theory was. But we obeyed.
Right.
But it was a theological thing. Something to do with the crucifixion, the Friday or something.
Hmm. Okay. He said that his family just didn't eat meat on Fridays, but they weren't Catholic. It was just, but he didn't know why they were doing it theologically. But anyway.
Fish was cheaper on Friday?
Oh. It was a pro. So what does God want from us out of this whole thing? You know, does he want us groveling? Is that what he wants? Does he want us, you know, to suffer? That's what makes God happy when we're suffer. Or is it seeking, you know, or is it self-discipline? And, you know, I think it always comes back to a matter of the heart, right? In these issues. I think that's what God wants. And we read the verse about that. You know, he withheld food from the children of Israel that were coming out of Egypt so that they might know, right? So he did it with a purpose. He wanted them to know something. Man does not live by bread alone, but by every word that proceedeth out of the mouth of God. So that was what he wanted from them in that particular instance. And there's other instances, and we'll get into this probably Friday, you know, in Isaiah 58, where they were fasting, and God says, stop it. You know, you're missing the point. This is like, and just like in Isaiah chapter 1 about, the, you know, they were offering all these sacrifices, and he says, your sacrifices are an abomination to me. Who's asked you to do this? Well, God, you're the one that asked us to do it. Not like this. Not like this. You're missing the point. You're missing the point, right? So, as I told you, one of the most fascinating things to me out of this whole study is I can only find one instance where people were fasting seemingly with good motives where their prayers were not answered the way they wanted. Only one time. I find that amazing. So here's some instances of successful fasting. Then all this is from Judges 20:26. Then all the Israelites and the whole people went off to Bethel. They wept and sat in Yahweh's presence. They fasted all day till evening and presented burnt offerings and communion sacrifices before Yahweh. And does anybody know what the context of this story is? No? Well, yes, it was, but why were the war is the interesting story. Right, right. Because of what? Why did they almost annihilate one of the tribes?
Because of corruption throughout Israel. Corruption of the tribes in Gibeah, but corruption throughout
right. The concubine story. Remember the concubine story in Judges? That story where you're kind of like, whoa. That's a horrible story, right? Well, that's right, John. Thank you. So this is the infamous concubine story. And the tribes had come together against Benjamin, and they had lost two battles. And after the first defeat, they wept, and they regrouped, and they tried again. And they were beat again. And then after the second defeat, they wept, and they fasted, and they won. Interesting. That's all I'm going to say about it. Here's another interesting story. Samuel said, "Muster all the Israel at Mizpah and it plead with Yahweh for you." So they mustered at Mizpah and drew water and poured it out before Yahweh, and they fasted that day and declared, "We have sinned against Israel." And Samuel was judge over Israelites at Mizpah, and they won. They throw off the oppression of the Philistines. So they fasted before they did that. Here's a really interesting story. You know the story, 1 Kings 21. Ahab is coaxed into killing Naboth over his nice little vineyard that he's got. And then Ahab is rebuked by Elijah. Now, of the kings of Israel, you know, how are you going to rank Ahab? At the top, right. Not at the top. Thank you. Yeah, he was the worst, or, you know, among the worst. We might be able to make a case for him. And Nasser or somebody, you know, we got some bad guys. But he's down there at the very, very bottom. But look what happens. In 1 Kings 21, it came to pass when Ahab heard these words, he rent his clothes and put sackcloth upon his flesh and fasted and lay in sackcloth and went softly. And the word of the Lord came to Elijah the Tishbite, saying, "See thou how Ahab humbled himself before me. Because he humbled himself before me, I will not bring the evil in his days, but in his son's days will I bring the evil upon his house." So Ahab, this worst of the worst, is granted a reprieve because, and really, we know the real answer is because he humbled himself before God, but he did it in fasting, you know. Maybe one of the lessons is when we have somebody that's a lost sheep, we should tell them, "You fast," you know. But anyway, he got reprieve, you know, went on his sons, but a lot of those people in those days didn't seem to mind that, which is another interesting story. Now, anybody know the only unsuccessful fasting story? David. And that we'll start with tomorrow.